Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Nick Lippis, and welcome to the Built for Trust podcast, where you get to hear from all the folks who are building and shaping AI enterprise infrastructure. Now, let's get right into it with our guests. Hey, Bob, welcome. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, absolutely.
Excellent. Well, Actually, I've really been looking forward to like this podcast. One, we've known each other for a good long time. You've been part of the Onu community from the very early days when you were over at GE. And then also, it's like all of the narratives that we were kind of really, I guess, advocating is probably the best term, over at Onu, you've been always kind of right there. Whether it was the SD-WAN stuff, the observability, you know, space, the NAS marketplace and how that's fundamentally changing, and now into the AI. So I'm really looking forward to like this chat, you know, with you. But I think, you know, it's like, I know you pretty well, but I'm not sure if everybody else does. So
sure.
Why don't we just give everyone like a little bit about, you know, your career journey, you know, and, you know, the GE group, like we have a lot of alum of GE, and it's almost like I kind of view them, you know, as like folks who went to a really good college or university, you know. There's a good group, you know, there. So anyway, so why don't you share a little bit about kind of your career journey?
Yeah, I think we've pollinated ourselves into the industry pretty well. I've actually been at it for about 35 years, which is a little bit scary. Definitely operating mostly in the networking space for the vast majority of that time. And I've probably spent half my time on the provider side and half my time on the enterprise side. I guess to give just a quick thumbnail sketch, right out of college, I actually made use of my electrical engineering degree for all of 3 years at GE Aerospace before I decided that wasn't for me anymore. And then I spent the next 10 years at AT&T, which was a lot of back office type of stuff. But the last 18 months was pretty exciting as a solution architect for AT&T Solutions. Was part of a $750 million deal with Citibank. And then I decided, after working for these massive companies, let me jump ship. It was dot-com era, 1997 or so. Went to work for a 50-person startup. Security based in the ISP out in California. But then we went bankrupt. And thankfully, GE was my client. GE asked me if I wanted a job, and that seemed like a really good idea. So I spent 17 years there, largely in procurement and running networking infrastructure and other parts of infrastructure. And then the last 6 years, I've been at Microland, which is probably, unfortunately, the world's best secret in network management, but Gartner thinks pretty highly of us. We've been MQ leader for the last 4 years, and as of last October, there's nobody ahead of us. So that's my career journey.
Yeah, that's actually really a great journey. I didn't know about the startup, you know, the security startup, you know, so you actually moved out to the West Coast, did that for a while. You know, it's like what I always tell my kids as well. It's like, there's no bad experience, you know, this is all experiential, you know, and it's all a journey, you know. So that was actually really, really good. I didn't know that part. So
I didn't move though. I took the red eye every Thursday night back home to New Jersey.
Oh my God. Yeah. You know, yeah. I did that in the 90s, you know. It's like I didn't do a startup, you know, but it's like there was like one part of the 90s. I think it was around kind of like 95, 96, you know, somewhere around there. I was on a flight to the West Coast every week, you know, for 8 months, you know. So, yep. You know, I got to know all the studiouses, you know, you know, a couple of group of people who are always doing the kind of same thing, you know. It's like,
you get to pay California state taxes when that happens. Yes.
There's nothing to brag about with any of that, you know. It was like really a grind. But anyway, we digress. But anyway, that was really great. Also, the part about AT&T and Citi, you know, that's a massive contract. Like, and that had to be in the late '80s, early '90s, you know, time frame.
It was
700, almost like, you know, $750 million. You know, that's huge.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
And that was basically to outsource all of their infrastructure.
The global network to AT&T at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure, you know, it turned out to be a bad outsourcing deal, like a lot of outsourcing deals, but it was fun to work on it.
Yeah. You know, it's like, it seems like there's like a pendulum on that, you know, it just kind of comes and it kind of goes, you know, and it's like, it all depends upon the economics at the time and the executive management that's there, whether they want to like support a group doing that, or they want to like have a throat to choke, you know, that's kind of it, you know, but anyway,
sure, it was extremely intense, literally 80 hours a week, just absolutely intense, but it was fun.
Yeah. Hmm. So anything in that journey that kind of sticks out as like career changing, you know, like this, wow, like, oh my God, I got to really just change this. And, you know, was there any kind of either a major aha moments, or were there like moments where you just like, oh my God, I got to change what I'm doing?
I'd say probably two. So early 90s. AT&T made us, you know, one of those go out into the woods for a week and, you know, sing Kumbaya. But the whole week was based on Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And I would say, if you've not read that book, or people listening not read that book, to me, it was life changing. Pretty much common sense, but it's very seven principles of how do you live your life. And I would say, even in year 2024, as much as in 1992, I literally apply it to my life in a personal way, as well as a business way. So that was a huge change for me. And then I think in the .com, having worked for, you know, these big companies, and you're a small cog in these huge wheels, I found myself in this 50-person company, and along came my former company, GE, and said, hey, we're thinking of building all of our first internet email gateways and www.ge.com, appliances.com, capital.com, all of the plastics.com. And so I was the solution architect, kind of operating without a safety net. It was, you know, I mean, it was just me to do that. So kind of a first time realizing, yeah, I can kind of do something on a big scale, but do it myself. And that kind of built up a lot of confidence in terms of, all right, no matter kind of what you throw me at, I'll lean into it instead of running away from it.
Awesome. Yeah, there's something about that first experience where the project is gonna, you know, fail or succeed based upon you.
Yeah.
You know,
that's exactly right.
And it's, yeah, you know, it's kind of like, okay, shit, this is either gonna happen or it's not gonna happen. You know, it's like you're, you know, it's a real moment of growth, you know, I think, you know, and you either shrink from it, or you really just like, you know, embrace it, you know, and take it over. Yep. And, you know, so yeah, awesome. Well, that's really great. Thanks for sharing that, you know, as well.
Sure.
So, so let's kind of bring us into like kind of more modern, you know, modern days. So like now you're the CTO, over at Microland. So, so the way I kind of view Microland is that, kind of a distributor and, you know, kind of managed service provider, you know, it's right. You know, so why don't you maybe just give a little background on that and your role?
Sure. So as of August, Microland will be around for 35 years. So, you know, not GE in longevity, but a decent amount of time to be a private company. I think, I mean, Microland grew up as kind of the first systems integrator in networking in India. First time John Chambers, Bill Gates came to India, it was at the host of my CEO, Pradeep Kaur. So we have kind of a good history. I think in the Y2K era, a lot of the Indian companies, you know, the HCLs, the Wipros, the TCS, Infosys, decided to get into BPO as well as application development. And Pradeep said, no, we're going to kind of stick in infrastructure management. And I guess there's good to that, and there's bad to that. I mean, the other companies I mentioned kind of rode that wave and went on to become multi-billion dollar companies. And so you could say maybe we missed the boat because of that. But I think part of the reason, you know, why we excel in the SI space is kind of sticking to infrastructure management and doing that well, and kind of the Kentucky Fried Chicken, right? Do one thing and do it well type of environment. So, you know, smaller organization, but definitely some very high marquee clients like GE Waste Management, Bridgestone Americas, Eli Lilly. I mean, LinkedIn, these are kind of household names. My role is we have kind of a sales organization, a solutions organization, and delivery organization. And I'm responsible in the solutions for coming up with our networking and cyber go-to-market service offerings, and any kind of bid that we do to the marketplace comes through my team.
Awesome.
But, okay, great. But one thing to correct you, we're not a distributor. Don't want to be a distributor. There's plenty of great distributors out there. We're just really into services.
Okay. All right. Great. System integrator. Okay. Got it. Yep. And yeah. Okay. Very good. So all right. That's enough of Microland. So I'll kind of give a little perspective on kind of like, you know, your experience there and what you're doing. So you've been spending a lot of time, you know, on kind of how AI is going to be impacting networking, security, in essence, compute infrastructure. And so I wanted to like, so let's start to talk a little bit, you know, about that. And and how companies either prepared or not prepared they are for this transition that's about to happen. So maybe let's start like, you know, like what do you think are like kind of the near term opportunities, you know, of how kind of AI technologies are going to impact infrastructure. And so the way that, you know, that we've been seeing, you know, AI, there aren't like a slew of new AI companies. You know, obviously there are like, you know, if you look at OpenAI and other companies like that, but I mean in our space, in the infrastructure space. So most of the technology is coming from established companies, right? And those would be offered by those, you know, companies as, you know, either enhancements to existing products or, you know, potentially new products from them, you know, especially around the operation space. So if you have a different view from that, you know, please feel free to share. But in essence, like, where do you kind of see like the big opportunities right now? How companies can take advantage?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I look at it two ways. I mean, from your OEMs, I mean, they're going to embed AI into their products, and that can often, you know, give you a great advantage. Juniper comes to mind, right? I think, in my opinion, they've got kind of a longer track record in doing that in kind of AI optimized products, but less about that and more about the enterprise themselves. Like, what can the enterprise do to lean into AI? Because I think you want to be master of your own domain. You don't want to let somebody else do that. So I think there's three things I could say, and there's a common theme, which is, look, networks, you know, have got lots of data, lots of complexity. And we've gotten to the point where it's really hard for the human brain, as magnificent as it is, to kind of wrap your head around, you know, all of this data and make inferences. So the three I would say, and I'll put them in order of kind of, you know, actually three, maybe four. The lowest hanging fruit, I think, is you use some kind of, you know, Gen AI tool, and there's many out there, to kind of perform what I would consider supportive, non-critical work. And so what am I talking about? Like, you know, you can use ChatGPT and say, go write me a postmortem. I mean, everybody needs to write postmortems, right? Or I'm coming in on day two, hour, you know, 17 of this long outage, and there's 52 pages of, you know, service management notes, right? And I, you know, I'm coming in new and I want to come up, you know, to speed quickly. Summarize that. Summarize what's going on so I can, you know, read in 20 seconds. So basically, I don't know if you'd call those administrative tasks, but I mean, basically leverage Gen AI to help assimilate a lot of information and help me come up to speed. But it's, I'll call that, yeah, non-critical work. And I think that's absolutely low-hanging fruit to go off and do that. I think the next level up is, so use some kind of AI or machine learning and have that platform make suggestions that humans can then consider and implement. And so I think about kind of predictive capacity management or Uber proactive capacity management, take all of my traffic flows, you know, where it's coming from, source destination, you know, enrich it with what's my business unit, what's my site, what's time of day, what's the application that's consuming it, stick all that into a data lake and let, you know, ML kind of tell you, you know, what you're growing. So either I can do proactive capacity management, or I can say, well, I didn't realize, you know, YouTube was taking up so much of my traffic. Let me, from a configuration management perspective, let me put that into a smaller box. So kind of like a virtual network assistant type of concept. Basically, I'm going to use AI and ML to make suggestions, but then the human is going to basically still pick up the ball from there and then kind of run with it. I think there's the third category of things that I think are out there. I'll kind of hand wave and call them the digital twin types of models, right? So I'm going to use this platform to simulate my network, to create an online virtual instance of it, so that, you know, if I want to execute a change, I can predict, you know, how that might operate and keep me from stepping into a bucket. I think the highest order value, but obviously the more complex, and probably been chasing this for a few years, is let me use AI and ML to not just assimilate or simulate, but let it find the anomalies and then, you know, take action to do self-heal and remediate. And, you know, I'll kind of hand wave and say, if we have self-driving cars, and we do, then we should have self-healing networks, right? I mean, kind of, we've been talking about intent-based networking probably since I joined ONUG back in 2015.
For sure.
You know, yeah. But, and so I think the reality of that in the next 3 or 5 years is like, that's going to happen, right? So how do you, and I think that comes a lot with, you know, pick a tool, pick a platform, but, you know, you learn more by doing than thinking. So go get your hands dirty, roll up your sleeves and go try something, and you'll fail, you know, 20 times, but go learn from that and figure out how to do it right the 21st time.
Yeah. Okay. So are those so there is the immediate low hanging fruit. Okay. Get me up to speed really quick. Consume this large amount of data, you know, get me, you know, so that I can kind of consume that, you know, write a postmortem, like all of those kinds of like a task that take time and a lot of thought time to do, but they're kind of administrative. The other one is to kind of like look at, you know, maybe some particular faults or some trouble spots, like, you know, within your infrastructure, be able to ingest that, you know, into a tool and have it make suggestions that you can then evaluate. And then the third area is more around kind of digital twin, you know, so simulate what I have. And then, it would be really interesting if it was like assimilate what I have, absorb all of the emitters all across, you know, an application's dependency map, so that kind of an AI orchestration tool can see everything that's happening in the network and the infrastructure, and then make suggestions, you know, once there are certain thresholds, you know. I think that's kind of like a little bit of a holy grail, you know, that we're kind of like aiming for around the digital twin scenario.
I mean, I think of, you know, you're starting to get into the AI ops realm, right? And so I think of AI ops as DevOps being on steroids, right? And if you think about how long DevOps took from the first time you heard about it, you know, culture change, learning, education, tool change, process change, organization change. And it probably took, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years for that to become kind of mainstream. So people don't really think about it anymore, right? Yeah. I mean, I think we're in that phase around AI ops where if you expect it to succeed in the next, you know, 6 months, 12 months, I mean, just quit fooling yourself, right? So lean into it, figure out, you know, the next little bit, and kind of, you're either in the game or you're out of the game. You might as well get in the game and try to go for it.
Yeah.
And then attend ONUG so you can figure out, you know, what your peers are doing.
Yeah, well, for sure. Like we're going to be like, there's like, we're kind of doing something called Triple T's, like at the coming up. Actually, it's going to happen all this year. And actually, ONUG is now being called like the AI Networking Summit at ONUG. Right. And so there's like all these like 15 to 20 minute presentations. And these are going to be for AI. It's either a tool, a technique, or technology. So to really expose the community of all the different kinds of AI tools that are available. So that's the category that you just talked about is actually really, you know, kind of interesting to think about. Mm-hmm. But are any other categories? Because I can think of probably two other categories, but go ahead.
Those are the ones that mostly come to my mind.
Okay. Well, one other that I'm thinking of is the what is kind of the redesign model for data centers to support AI workloads, you know, because I think one thing that, and I'm sure you've heard this, you know, as well, is that there's many large corporations are not going to use public AI, right? Because like, you know, those queries are attack vectors, you know, sure. They're vulnerabilities, you know? So, so that means there'll be a lot of either private or semi-private, you know, kind of, whether those are LLMs or other versions of AI. But the bottom line is that how do you now start thinking about the design patterns for how your data center is going to change over the course of the next couple of years? So I think that's one. And then the other one is not, so we've been talking more about kind of operational stuff. You know, it's like you mm-hmm. have engineers and what they're doing, like in their job and how, you know, AI might be able to support them and help them. But there's another attribute that's happening here or dimension that's happening. And that is whether you're a security company or a networking company, the two are converging as we know, but AI is moving deeper into the protocol stack. You know, so how does routing change? How does the relationship between the infrastructure and the applications change? So some of the kind of the vision, you know, of how this may transpire, you know, kind of, I'm not sure if this is the end state or kind of moving towards an end state, is that the network will not just be a connectivity device where it's just connecting devices, you know, together, but the network will integrate security into it. So these are secure connections where the posture of these connections can be assessed in real time. And then that is presented to the application. So the applications can have kind of either a say or have some influence over how the application utilizes that service. And that could be guided by kind of either policy as code or guidelines around how kind of that AI should work and may work. So that relationship changes, you know, between infrastructure teams, developers, and the machines that manage the application dependency. And then on the operations side, we move more and more towards lights out operations. So I think, you know, to me, that's kind of like really where, while we're starting, you know, I wouldn't say we're starting slow at all, because this is going to like happen freaking quick. But it's like, it seems like, you know, it's like right now we're just starting to understand the tools, but once we understand them, they'll move quick. So I don't know. What do you think of, you have any response, you know, to that kind of vision?
Yeah, I think to the first one you said, you described it as kind of data center, but I mean, I think one of the challenges is like, you know, where is my data and where do I put my processing? So I'm sure you kind of meant when you say data center, it's a core edge type of hybrid model, right? So maybe that's, you mentioned pendulum, right? Before, I thought this pendulum of life of centralization and decentralization, right? So we kind of had everything decentralized on-prem and then we all go to the cloud to centralize, and now we're kind of pendulum swinging back in other direction to say, yeah, I have some pretty important, you know, core edge or pretty important edge locations, right? To where I pick up my data, and do I transmit all of my data, you know, up to the core, or do I just, you know, apply some AI at the edge and then I translate my transfer my alerts up to the core. So I think those are all, to your point is, you've got to rethink your design patterns of right how you do that kind of processing. And I definitely think that's right. Far as the AI coming into protocol, I think that makes sense. I don't know that I personally have, you know, too many light bulbs to sprinkle anything on, you know, any kind of wisdom on top of what you already said, but certainly something to lean into. I think, you know, you got to dream it first. If you can, it's back to Stephen Covey, you know, begin with the end in mind, right? If I can say what the end is, then I can reverse engineer and figure out how to get there. So all of that stuff is going to have to work sooner or later, hopefully sooner.
Yeah. Yeah. Data governance and data gravity is the big question.
Sure.
You know, in this space, you know, it's like, I'm not sure if we're going to see many hybrid kind of AI models, you know, maybe we will, you know, but I think, you know, like, I think we learned from the cloud, you know, experiences that once you move data into the cloud, moving it back and forth is prohibitive in cost, you know? And so, so I think there's a reluctance kind of to go into that model. So, you know, I think there, and we'll talk about data governance at this coming up ONUG, you know, as well, sure. in respect to, you know, hybrid AI models as well. So I think that's a really core thing, key thing. And you mentioned something, you know, Bob, and I'd love to, like, you know, maybe a double click on it. And that there is the other part of the industry where this has influence on is where kind of networking, cloud and AI converge at the edge, you know, kind of the enterprise edge. So, and you mentioned it. So, like, you know, so what's your thinking there on that space and how that's evolving?
I mean, I think one of the holy grails about enterprising adopting AI is, you know, and I'll be coarse grain here, right? Unless your name is like LinkedIn or Google or something like that, most of the Fortune 500, 50,000, whatever, still has this very traditional smokestack, you know, kind of organizational model when it comes to IT, right? So pick me an enterprise, you know, that doesn't have a digital workplace team and a network team, and maybe the network team subdivided into the WAN and the LAN and the firewall team, and you got a cloud team and a data center team and
virtualization
you know,
team,
you know, application teams, right? Platform teams, tools teams, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the trick is everybody, you know, manages to their own budget. They've got their, I mean, yes, there's some sharing of tools, especially when it comes to like an ITSM tool. But I mean, for monitoring capability, for automation capability, for performance management, for configuration management, it, you know, if I can overgeneralize, everybody's got their own soup and they're, you know, they're making their own soup themselves. So I think part of the challenge here and you know is how do I turn that on its side? And now, like, I want telemetry from all these different spaces. And telemetry is more than just threshold-based, you know, metrics that we tend to have used for the last 15 years. You know, we're throw on top of that. I need that, but I need logs. Logs are a very rich source of information. I need usage. I need configuration. I need all that data. And so when I was talking about edge versus core, I think you're going to have to collect some of that data at the edge and mix it all together into some model and draw your inference out of it. I don't know that you can process all that data in real time and send it up, you know, to the cloud and back. So that's more what I was referring to as maybe it's a hybrid data lake, but it's data lake / AI processing, I guess, is what I think, and maybe what I think is wrong, and that's fine. But that's what I was referring to is where do you put that where do you put your data storage, especially as you mentioned, like, you know, regulatory compliance, all that governance type of stuff. And then from a processing perspective, how does that lay out so it's as efficient as possible?
Well, it seems like the security teams are the ones who are really built from an infrastructure basis, are the ones who built the data lakes, right? Yeah. It's either it's like the security teams or the observability teams. The networking teams, not so much, you know. So there's already data lakes there. So the question is that, you know, can we can these data lakes ingest networking data along with security data, you know? And so there are like, you know, there are companies like Splunk, you know, that are out there, but like that stuff is so proprietary, you know, it's like, and they charge, and Datadog as well. So you got Datadog and you got Splunk. And then as those logs, you know, as the data goes to petabits, you know, per day, you know, and above, you know, your bills get really, really high. So there needs to be a kind of a different model there. But I think there is a way to ingest, capture, you know, that data. I think there needs to be a way to kind of also reduce the amount of data, you know, as well. So like, you know, you can actually do some pre-processing, you know, of that. But I'm totally with you if what you're basically saying is that it would be really great if we could, you know, have all of the emitters of an application's dependency map being guided towards some data lake, you know, repository. I hope that's the right term. You know, into which now we have a common data format where we can actually do some really interesting, not just AI around capacity planning and orchestration and automate those, but in essence, really incident response. So to me, it's like we're seeing a lot of activity, and we're actually going to have some discussions about this coming up in ONUG, is the integration of NOx and SOX and that operational model integration and how AI plays a role, you know, within that. So that, to me, that's a really exciting space because that's a transformative space. You kind of transform these silos of operations into an integrated incident response, you know, center that hopefully can act quicker and that can be much more automated so that, you know, there's like, I think right now there's about 750,000 open recs for security engineers and about the same on networking, you know? And so when we know that we're never going to like close that gap, we also know that the data is never going to slow down either, you know? So the only way to kind of solve this, you know, to get control over that is really to automate. I think there's kind of four
core, you know, problems to solve. They're all related, but somewhat different, right? So the first is knowing what to collect and having access to it and steering it somewhere, right? So just that's the fuel, you know, the telemetry data is your fuel behind the observability engine. I think, you know, these days infrastructure is not static, right? So the relationships change. So even as you're pulling that data into whatever lake and model that you have, you have to understand what's connected to what as it relates to an application, right? So if it's my ERP application, you know, is made up of these containers and these switches and these routers and, you know, these servers and this data storage, and that's going to change maybe on a second by second basis. So you have to not only ingest that telemetry problem one, you need to know dynamically how that infrastructure is related in support of some application, if that's your target. Problem two. Problem three, I need to know what good health of that application is. How do I represent good health in my model so that I can detect anomalies to that health and say, hey, something seems to be wrong. And then step four, when I see an anomaly, you know, Nirvana is I connect it to some CI/CD, you know, change as a transaction type of thing to remediate it. But if not, you know, pop it up to some chat ops where, you know, a human can then query using natural language, you know, what's changed or what, you know, tell me what to do next, you know, kind of stuff, right? And over time, to me, that's the new version of problem management. Problem management back in the, you know, a decade ago was you looked at all your P1s and P0s and you figured out, you know, how to reduce those over time. I think the new version of problem management is you look at what do I need to do to remediate from a problem? And I want to automate as many of them as possible. So, you know, when I start, I might be automating 0.1% of my remediation actions. But if you are able to record what the engineer is doing to resolve that, and then you set a team to figure out how to code what that person just did, then you can forever increase your percentage of, you know, automated actions. And to me, that's the new form of problem management.
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah. So I think you just have kind of a framework and a structure, you know, around this this problem of, you know, it's interesting because, like, you know, the biggest discussion points right now in the kind of the general AI industry is like, where do you get data? What do you pay for that data? How much do you pay for that data to, like, you know, feed into the learning of your models? In the enterprise, we don't have that problem. We have plenty of data. You know, it's like, and so it's really all about the putting into a data governance model on how you collect that data, what the format of that data is. And that's a really hard problem, you know, for a lot of, because that means agreement across a lot of different companies. And there are no standards organizations that are dealing with any of this, you know. You would just think that it's going to have to be something on the order of, like, there is a massive business opportunity in order to be able to ingest this data and then to, put it into a format that is canonical so that it can actually be used. And I think the business model has got to get, it's got to be big. That's got to be, like, you know, clearly tens of billions of dollar opportunity, if not more, you know, and maybe that just hasn't been articulated yet or materialized yet.
I definitely think that that's, you know, food and water foundational level type of challenge around AI is, what data do I need? Where do I get it from? Where do I store it? How do I ingest it? How do I model it? Who has access to it? And I forget, I think it might even have been an ONUG event. I never thought of, like, who has the authority to access that, right? So, like, just because ChatGPT can answer something, you know, if you're N-5 in the organization, maybe it shouldn't give you the answer. If you're, you know, N-1 in the organization, maybe you're authorized to get the answer, right? So,
yeah.
But the data is definitely kind of a foundational challenge.
Yeah, well, the ownership is really key too, because some of the vendors within our industry basically say, hey, that's my data, I own it, even though it's like running your network. You know, and so they put restrictions on, you know, if you can actually see it or if you can see it, because the theory is that provides insight into, like, how my products are actually working or not working. And so, yeah, there's a whole bunch of issues. I'm sorry.
That's another pendulum of life. Open, proprietary, open, proprietary. I mean, I think open wins in the end, right? Proprietary can win for a little bit of time, but then people don't want to put up with it.
Yeah.
Nobody likes a black box.
That is true. All right. So you've also been doing some work on obstacles on IT teams. Like, what's, like, getting in their way? Is it skills? Is it culture? In order for them to be ready for, like, this new world that we're entering into?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like, I think the biggest problem is a layer 8 problem, which is, you know, should never be a surprise. Meaning, you know, it's above the OSI stack and it's in the human brain, right? What I said earlier, I mean, we all like to think, like, oh, that's not me. You know, I don't act that way. But I do think, you know, leaning into developing some of this stuff just challenges the very structure that enterprises are based off, right? So you have to give up your current role and your current structure and your nice, safe, secure type of role that you've had for the last 15 years, right? To kind of do this stuff, because it's going to be cross-tower, it's going to be cross-functional. So I think from the conversations I've had the last couple of years, everybody thinks it's an awesome idea. When I say everyone, clients that I speak to, like, yes, we should do this. Okay. Do you have a POC we could do? You know, where would you like to start? Oh, hold on a second. Let's start backpedaling. And there could, you know, it could be because of what I said, or, you know, security teams get involved? What are you doing? And it just, if you can't decide and act on something in a couple of months, then people get tired and you lose your way. And I feel like there's an inertia towards getting started. So I would encourage, there's certain things that are just not, the train's left the station and it's not going back in, right? So you can hide if you want to from AI coming. I don't think that's a very wise thing, right? And I'm sure you can have a career for the next 20 years being in a place that AI is not touched, but I'll tell you, it's probably not a very interesting place to be. So I would say, are you going to break some glass? Are you going to, create some problems? Yeah, sure. But, have some fun with it while you do it, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was talking with Gene's son from FedEx a couple of weeks ago. Gene had this really great quote. It was like saying, and we were kind of talking about the organizational, stuff and the skills, and the skill stuff and the change that's, about to happen, and where people feel threatened. And so they're like, well, this AI thing, is going to take my job, And so the thing is, like, AI is not going to take your job. So this is Gene's perspective. AI is not going to take your job. People with AI skills are going to take your job.
There you go. Exactly.
So it's like, if you put your head in the sand, oh my God, man, your butt is going to get lawnmowered over, you're saying one of the impediments is around culture and around resistance to change.
Yeah.
Now I'm not sure if you've seen this model as well, but, I know that there's more than a handful of CEOs in Fortune 100 companies, like 100 companies that are putting in shadow AI groups and basically appointing a chief AI officer. And that's both for kind of like the business side of things. Okay, well, what can be doing on the business side of it to enhance their products, make them more competitive, speed, speed to market, so forth and so on. But also they see this problem within IT organizations. And so the chief AI officer is also being viewed as an adversarial role to the CIO because there's concern that the CIOs, not the CIO themselves, but their teams are going to have that cultural inertia, to change. And that the only way to get that to change is competition, And so I'm not sure if you're seeing that, manifest itself.
I'm sure. I mean, to me, there's two sides of that coin. You can do it in a constructive way, or you could do it not in a destructive, but a competitive way, right? So oftentimes, if you want to change the machine can't change itself, right? It's the inertia sets in, right? So if you want to do something that's radically different, then yes, create a small group, what AWS calls it, the pizza teams, right? Whatever, 8 people or less, and go set them off, to a different course. And I guess you can do it outside the bounds of IT, what you're suggesting. Although, I mean, there's AI as it applies to IT, and then there's AI as it applies to the business, right? So I could see setting it up outside of IT, maybe more if you're doing it for business reasons or business productivity than IT productivity. But I don't know that there's a right or a wrong. I tend to be Pollyanna-ish. I think that everybody should get along and share information and, do the right thing together, but the world doesn't necessarily always operate that way. So I do think that there is such a thing as shadow AI. If the central organization doesn't adopt it quickly enough, doesn't lean into it quickly enough, then people get tired of waiting and they start to do it themselves. Yeah. I'm going to overgeneralize again, the type of people that get tired of waiting and do it themselves are usually the people that are worried about functionality and not necessarily about how they got that functionality. So, I mean, having been at an enterprise like GE and understanding how deep cyber risk goes, how deep compliance and regulatory goes, and if you want to mess up your business, just go ahead and violate one of those things and see what you get, right? Yeah. So the trouble with that, I guess everybody, you know, people would have, shadow AI would have good intention, but I would say it's more, relatively more likely that they could lose data that they didn't intend to lose, or that they could use the wrong model without really understanding it, therefore draw the wrong conclusions, therefore make bad business decisions. And look, it's not a 0-1 world, right? Nobody's perfect, nobody's whatever, but I think there's elements of shadow AI that's good because you're trying to stimulate the machine to do something differently. But if you don't have some guardrails around it, you could, I guess, seriously hurt yourself at the same time.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I haven't heard anybody not putting guardrails in, you know, yeah. You know, for, you know, how to proceed with this. And, you know, and actually there's like at least two sessions on kind of guardrails, you know, around AI. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing with the shadow AI teams is that they're mostly focused around how to enhance existing business, right? Yeah. And not so much of the IT, but you can't do one without the other because everything is digital, you know? Yeah. So I think that's, you know, so it's going to bleed into the IT organization. And I think that's, to me, you know, that's a big message, you know, for us to be communicating as a community, is that, you know, this isn't like, it is and it isn't, you know, but it's like, this is going to happen a lot quicker than the cloud stuff happened. And we thought that happened pretty quick. Mm. And because it's all software, you know, and the models learn pretty quick, you know, and the only company that I think is like, you know, been like, oh my God, this has taken so long is IBM with Watson. You know, it's like, they've had like AI for like, I don't know what, a decade or so, you know, and it's like, and all of a sudden, boom, it's here. And it's like, oh my God, this guy finally here. But I think it's that within organizations that if you are putting your head in the sand on this cycle, your ability to kind of just be a resistance movement is going to be limited. But I think there's a flip side to this as well. And that is, just like we had in the cloud era, where you had a lot of the kind of accounting firms, you know, like the EY and the Andersons and so forth, the Deloittes, they were really pushing the cost savings message around cloud the early days. And that turned out to be false, you know? I think, and they're at it again, because I think that's what a lot of CEOs, that's what they're hearing. They're hearing you can take a lot of OpEx out of your model. Like the service providers, the telecom service providers are a prime example. Like, you know, they spent, you know, tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions, like on spectrum, especially around the 5G space. And they've basically been saying, listen, we're going to be able to reduce operations. And they're really hoping that AI is going to have a major reduction in their OpEx, you know, spend. And I think, you know, CEOs are seeing the same thing, because really when it comes down to it, a lot of CEOs, they still view IT as a, you know, as a cost center and not as a business center, you know. Yeah. And this is really apparent.
Any company has got what, like 2-4% of their revenue is IT budget, and then, you know, the 96-98% is your business, right? So I would never look at something like this as cost savings. It's, you know, to me, it's more agility, right? So making you go faster enables a lot more productivity out of that 96-98%, you know, whatever that spend is on in your business processes. So if you want to know where the real savings is, it's getting your IT organization to be more agile by adopting, you know, AI, so you get the answer is quicker, everything goes faster. And when everything goes faster, your M&A goes faster, your projects go faster, your customer experience initiatives go faster, and, you know, your ability to innovate and decide to do different things goes faster. There is one other challenge that I don't think we mentioned, which is, and I do hear this, you know, talking to clients, is what happens when you do what when AI does something, or you do what it tells you to do, and it was wrong, right?
Yeah. How do you trust?
Yeah, exactly. And so I think, you know, we're kind of used to human error and like, oh man, we messed up. So, do your RCA and, we'll do better next time. But I think the first time that, a company has a serious problem because, AI, was the cause, I don't think as culturally as humans, we're as forgiving to our computers as we are to ourselves. So I think that's a, or maybe it makes people very tentative, right? They're afraid of that. They're not willing to be tolerant of even a small piece of broken glass. So therefore they hold back, right? But I think that's another challenge of, nothing's perfect. So something's going to break, right? That you didn't intend to.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I think we're going to hit that topic as well. It's like, how do you gain trust, in these models?
Yeah.
Because actually Chris Moretti, Chris and I talked about this, on the podcast, and really it is all about trust. Right. Mm-hmm. And, so I brought up years ago, Cisco introduced something called MAC. I think it's media access. It's not like media access control, but it was like it. Basically, what happened is that there might be an anomalistic behavior on the network, and so the network then would create a private VLAN where that can be remediated. All that traffic would go into that VLAN and hang out in that quarantined kind of the broadcast domain, right? So where the blast radius was really controlled, right? Yeah, if there was something, something bad, no one used it. They were afraid. They're afraid to use it, and that was just simple. That was like, okay, great. Hey, anomalistic traffic here. Boom, move it over here. And Chris's rebuttal to that, was like, well, that was just on like one piece of data, But like with AI, it's going to have so many other sources of data to cross examine to assure that, this is a truly anomalistic event and to really take action. So I think Chris is like, Chris finds comfort in the number of sources of data and the ability to correlate that data, or the hope to correlate that data,
I mean, I would agree relatively. Your trust could probably be higher, but something's going to break sooner or later anyway. It just does. It always does.
Yeah.
And then you can turn it off and turn it back on and it'll work again.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as it it doesn't totally mess up your brand, it's like, I'm not sure. There are little problems and big problems, right?
Exactly.
So we'll see what happens, but there will be a major, We know it will happen, but those are learning steps like with our industry, it's like it's to be expected.
As long as it happens to somebody else's enterprise, I'm fine with it.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, anyway, one last thing, Bob, and do you have a favorite AI tool?
I mean, tongue in cheek, my favorite AI tool is, either AWS or Netflix recommendation engine, but, I think, obviously, there's different versions of ChatGPT. That's very cool. I got introduced to Copilot just recently. Maybe it's been out there for a long time, but I mean, that's pretty interesting to be able to just, summarize meeting minutes and stuff like that. But
everybody's using Copilot. Yeah,
it's pretty slick.
Everybody.
I mean, not to give a commercial out to my friends at Juniper Network, but I've been pretty impressed with their whole Marvis platform. I think I met Sudhir Mehta back in 2018, and I see them doing phenomenal things within their product with AI. So to me, it's a good poster child for how you should be operating.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. That's great, Bob. Hey, thanks so much. This was actually a lot of fun. I really enjoyed, you know, chatting with you about it, and you know, look forward to seeing you hopefully in Dallas.
I will see you in Dallas
for the AI Networking Summit. So, awesome. Thanks, Bob.
All right. Take care.